theme for tonight is an extension of what we talked about as the attitude of the therapist for his client, the attitude of the option method guide for the person. And this is an extension of that. We were discussing the therapeutic relationship, and tonight I thought we might discuss more what the therapeutic relationship is and also how it's different from any other relationship, if it's different, and why it's different. And the theme for my talk tonight is the freedom to be happy and all freedoms that are implied, for instance, the freedom in being happy, the freedom that we have in being happy, the freedom that we have in wanting others, letting others be happy, the freedom that we have in letting others be unhappy, etc. So freedom regarding happiness. Basic attitude of the option method guide, therapist, practitioner, whatever you want, is to realize that I have no responsibility for the unhappiness of my client. Now that's essential. It's also one of the biggest hang-ups that helpers often face. I'm here only as a servant to do what I can. For whatever reason, I may not help someone to become happier. The worst that I have done is to leave them wherever they choose to be. They choose to be unhappy, and they have chosen to be unhappy before they came to be with me. They may even choose to be more unhappy while they are with me. That is their right, their freedom. They do not have to be happier for my sake. If I want somebody to be happier for my sake, it will be me. I will be happier for my sake. I do not have to be happy for their sake. If they want somebody to be happy for their sake, it could be them. They can be happy for their own sake. Everything that they do is for their sake, my clients. That cannot change. Everything I may do is for me in some way. And by this I'm trying to point out the total aloneness of each individual in this world, the total separateness and the total independence. We meet each other with our own personal beliefs and the desires that go with those beliefs. They're ours. We may change them, but each of us change them for ourselves, for our own sake. I'm not deluded. If they are happier after being with me, it is because they chose to be happier. Their happiness is totally of their own creation. They do whatever they do for their sakes, not mine. Love is being happy. I'm loving you if I'm happy with you. Love, though, is what I do, what I'm doing for me. I'm being happy. Love is so universally admired and approved of and feels so basically good because when someone is loving another, they're not presenting them with an event that the other feels they must be unhappy about. Somehow, you know, we feel we're loved because the person who's loving us is just not giving us events, if you want, or presenting us with things that we feel we have to be unhappy about. Then it is possible, after people are like that with us, then it's possible, if we're not going to be unhappy, then to be happy with all the other presents, the presented events that they give to us. So in a loving relationship, we find that we're not unhappy about what they present to us, which then leaves us free to be happy and happier about what is presented to us. Then it's possible to be open to new presence. Often, it is called love when the lover removes the event that the beloved believes they must be unhappy about. Now, I'm talking about this because this is sometimes seen as a role of the therapist, and the role of the therapist is to love. And sometimes it's seen a function of loving to take away the thing that the person is unhappy about. That's a protective lover. That kind of loving is protective.
Like stop drinking when you're still unhappy.
Well, like you're afraid of spiders that go around and kill all the spiders. Whatever it is that you're unhappy about, I'll take it away. I guess if I'm unhappy about your drinking, if you love me, you'll stop drinking, might be a way I'll feel, sure. And this is usually the romantic ideal of a lover, a servant protector, like a knight, of needs and fears. And it's often called love when somebody just protects and serves the needs and fears of another person. This is often a one-to-one dyad, sometimes extended to the family, sometimes it's expanded. In this kind of relationship, it is also often called love when the lover presents tokens that represent that original serving, protecting, need, fear relationship. For instance, if the lover gives candy, flowers, or other non-practical special gifts, it affirms to the beloved that the lover wants them to be happy and is willing to protect and serve even when it only seems like whimsy on the beloved's part. You know, you have no need for flowers, really, but I love you, I'll give them to you. You have no need for candy. These things are not practical. And I'm trying to show you by giving you impractical things that I'll protect you and I'll be with you and I'll care for you, even when there are things that I don't value, even when they're just whimsy on your part. In this relationship, the most loving lover would be the one who would tolerate the silliest fears and protect the beloved from their most self-defeating behavior. You know, a woman says, oh, I just can't stand that. And he says, oh, don't worry here, I'll take care of it. No matter how silly he may think it is, that makes him a tremendous lover. And the more silly she may get, and in our society that's frequently the case, the more protective he seems, especially if he starts protecting her from things that he knows that she wouldn't ever have to really be afraid of. The lover would protect even from things that he saw no need for someone to be protected from. And this is the medieval romantic ideal. Even making up and inventing challenges and trysts and searches and things like that in order to prove one's love, even when they're not there, just to show that you'd be ready in case they were. And so the romantic knight might very well go fight another man just simply because that other man was there to fight, and say he was doing it for his beloved. Do all kinds of things, maybe climb a high mountain and come back with a flower. And he'll go through many trials and tests and challenges. Well, we have a modern counterpart to that too, and it's still called love. In this kind of relationship, it's also called love when the lover gives presents that not only remove the original fear need, but also extend that removal to a greater emotional distance. Remember we said it was loving if we take away the things that the lover is afraid of. Okay, well now we not only take them away, but we start giving presents and gifts that symbolize that taking away and show that we're even further away, you have less to be afraid of. So for instance, if a beloved fears poverty, the lover would give the beloved more and more substantial safeguards and proofs of their distance from poverty. So for instance, a house, a second car, a maid, insurance. Anything that would then remove the lover, the beloved, further and further away from the thing they fear, they would all be seen as gifts and presents and proof of love. Although these presents may serve the lover's needs, they are presented basically, though, as being for the beloved. I gave her a new refrigerator for her kitchen. You know, sounds like I don't even eat. The whole idea being it's got to be for that other person, even though I would like a new refrigerator in my kitchen or in our kitchen. The whole idea is, here's a new refrigerator, dear, for your kitchen. Often a present is valued only in proportion to its lack of value to the presenter. If you valued it very much, the person you were giving it to, your lover, your beloved, would not value it as much then, would not see it as much of a gift. It's pretty much as if the husband said, on a Sunday afternoon after he washed the car, I washed the car for you, dear, and she never even drives it. Somehow, she wouldn't feel that that was a present. That the gift has to be seen in this kind of a relationship, the gift would have to be seen as not being for the lover, but for the beloved. So that she wouldn't see things as gifts if he really wanted her to have them. She would only see them as gifts if he knew that she wanted to have them. Let's say if she were constantly complaining about the kind of ties he wears, then she went and bought him a new tie that she liked, and she said, now here's a nice tie for you. He's liable not to feel that that's much of a gift. In fact, he may even resent it, because she values the gift too much. So when the presenter values the gifts, it proportionately takes away from its value as a love token. In this relationship, it's also called love when the lover gives sexual pleasure to the beloved without regard to their own pleasure. Often, in fact, using the same principle, if it seems that the lover values the activity more than the beloved, then the above factor comes in. The beloved may even resent the gift in proportion to the value for the giver. So there are those two factors. A present is valued in proportion to its lack of value to the presenter, and resented in proportion to the value for the presenter. Now, in all these above aspects, it's the feeling that the lover makes the beloved happy or happier, either by removing bad things or giving good things. Well, anyway, in this kind of love relationship, what becomes clear is it's all based on that romantic ideal that the lover makes the beloved happy or happy, either by removing bad things or giving good things. This also only has this effect of loving if it somehow affirms that it's being done primarily for the sake of the beloved. That's the thing that has to become clear in each of these examples, these proportionate things I was talking about. What becomes clear is that the gift is supposed to be for the sake of the beloved, not for the sake of the lover. To the degree that it's for the sake of the lover, it's less a gift. In this relationship where they believe they're making each other happy, ultimately a sexual problem will arise. I have not found any relationship based on this that hasn't had sexual problems involved in it. Because, you see, if for one reason or another one of the partners in a sexual relationship just isn't turned on, they will start to resent that the other one is turned on. Start to feel that they're being used. That's very frequently a symptom of what happens in this kind of thing. He or she values sexual activity more than I do. This kind of love's greatest test is when the beloved needs something contrary to the lover's need, which may be most of the time, which tends to grow to become more and more of the time. This love has sacrifice, duty, responsibility, disappointment, selfishness, etc. in its vocabulary. These are the kind of words that you'll find being used by these kinds of lovers. Duty, sacrifice, selfishness, disappointment. This unhappy fear, need, love is sometimes changed into a happy wanting love, where the lover wants to give the gift of self and wants to help the beloved to enjoy that gift more fully. This lover will desire to protect and serve the beloved's happiness, not only by removing the bad, but by helping the beloved to stop fearing and being unhappy with the bad, the non-desirable. This lover will help the beloved to be happy, not only by giving the good things, but by helping the beloved to be more and more open here with the good things and the desirable things. And we define good and bad as bad are those non-desirable things and good are those desirable things. This lover is happy with the beloved's loving behavior and not unhappy with the non-loving behavior. Not threatened, not scared, not frightened. This lover is happy with the beloved's hopes and not unhappy with their fears. This love may not have any vocabulary. Now, this is the kind of love an option method guide will have for his or her clients. That's the reason why I distinguish between the both of them. Because I love my clients, I will not pretend that their unhappiness is not theirs and that they need to be protected from the things that they're unhappy about. I'll not bail them out by giving them what they believe they have to have from me before they will allow themselves to be happy with me. Since I love them, I will not pretend to save them. I will not pretend that they are not totally responsible for their judgments, their beliefs, and their concomitant emotions. If they hate me for being who I am, I will not hate them by pretending that I am responsible for their self-imposed hate. It is not love to help another believe that they are helpless. It's not love to help another believe that their happiness depends on who I am and how I behave. So now, let's say in a session, if I do not think of the right questions to ask them in our sessions, it's not their fault in any way. But neither is it my fault if their unhappiness and their happiness depends on my questions. And this is something that an option method guide who's going to remember, who wants to help people. If I do not think of the right questions to ask them in our sessions, it's not their fault in any way. If I've blocked, if I've forgotten, if I'm distracted, if I'm confused, if I'm unclear, it's not their fault, regardless of how they may have acted. But neither is it my fault or my responsibility in any way if their happiness depends on my questions. I did not set up their lives that their happiness has to depend on my questions. Basically, what we're talking about is the therapist's freedom to not do therapy. I will not play games to satisfy their demands. If I love them, I won't do that. I will give them absolutely nothing just because they're unhappy with my not giving it. If they're unhappy with my not giving them something, I'm not going to give it to them just because they're unhappy with not having it. Maybe I'll give it to them, maybe I won't, but that won't be my reason. I won't play their games. Perhaps I'll be the first person in their lives to not be afraid of their threats against themselves. Their threat to make themselves unhappy if I don't do what they want. It is not love to show them that their unhappiness pays off, that their unhappiness with me gets me what they want. If, on the other hand, I do give them what they want, it will be in spite of their unhappiness And if they want to believe I've given it, I've given in to their threats, so be it. I'm not obliged to give them what they demand, nor am I obliged to not give them what they demand. I'm totally free, and I will be totally free. That is loving them. I do what I wish. They will behave as they wish. I'm loving them. I'm loving my clients by giving only exactly no more, no less than what I'm happy to give. In time, they may realize that they are really being loved. They will know that when I am giving something, it is truly, freely, happily given. And that whatever I do give, there is no resentment behind it. And so then they will know that I could never resent their asking or demanding for what I don't give, since I am freely and happily also refusing to give and not giving. If I am happy, they may know that they're loved. And I know that they're loved. Now, if this is the nature of a loving relationship, how is it different? Now, what does it mean? I'm an option method guy because, why? Because people who want me to help them to be happier motivate me to do that. I'm a guide or a therapist, whatever you want to call it, for some people and not for others. Because those that I am for are the ones who have motivated me to be that way for them.
All right, you'll give me $15. I'm motivated.
Whatever. Whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Or they may have nothing to do with money. Mm-hmm. The difference between being an option method practitioner lover and a lover in other relationships is simple. Essentially, there's no real difference. I love and I'm happy with everybody. Some motivate me to be with them in some ways, others in other ways, and still others not at all. I love or I'm happy with all. Some motivate me to be with them in some ways, others in other ways, and still others not at all. In an option method session, I am the lover by helping the other to be happier. In what we might call a mutually loving relationship, I am also the beloved, and am being helped to be happier. In the option method session, I agree to not seek help from this person, but only to help. And that in form or in style would be the only difference. And so that the difference between a professional or a non-professional relationship is that in friendships, I'm motivated by whatever there is in that friend or in that person to be with them for whatever there is to be with them. I will help them, they will help me, I will love them, they will love me. I am the beloved as well as the lover to one degree or another. In the session, I ask none of that from my client. I do not ask them to love me. I do not ask them to be happy with me, which is something I might ask from my friends. I do not ask them to understand me, appreciate me, applaud me, hug me, or to do anything for me that helps me to be happy with them. Do not ask them to do anything that has to do exactly with that loving, beloved relationship. A professional session is one where I ask for something other than love in return for my help. And that's perhaps what makes all business, quote-unquote, or professions, and their relationships other than friendship relationships. When I go to the butcher, he doesn't ask me for my love, I don't ask him for his love. I ask him for his meat, he asks me for my money. And that's it. We're not asking for love from one another. In this relationship, I am being asked for love. But I'm not asking for it in return. In each, I am happy. In each, I try to help the other to be happy. In each, I may receive many things I want. In one, though, in the therapeutic relationship, I am only wanted for one particular skill or task. In the other, I may be wanted for other abilities, for other qualities of mine. What makes the professional relationship sell is the desire of the seeker, the desire of the client, the desire of the petitioner, of the beloved. All they want from me is my skill. All they ask of me is that task. They want to use me that way. So that is going to delineate, perhaps, the relationship. Again, it's not so much that I'm going to approach it differently, but that the client is basically approaching it differently. And in line with this, I have a thought which I headed, which may sum this whole thing up, and I hope will serve as a guide for you in your practices. And it really is essential, and it does follow from the things that we've talked about previously. It may be the hardest thing for you to ever get in touch with. As you get happier, you'll get more in touch with it. It may sound to you strange now. It may sound to you like many, many things. But in time, it will begin to have more and more meaning to you. I am not the cause, is what I call it. And my thoughts ran this way. And if you bear with me, you may get the gist of what I'm thinking. If you decided that you had to be unhappy, then you were unhappy freely and for your own sake. And we're talking about our clients now. If you decided to seek me out, then you sought me freely and for your own sake. If you decided to ask for my help, then you asked for my help freely and for your own sake. If you decided to try to motivate me to help you, well, then you try to motivate me freely and for your own sake. If you decided to meet my conditions, then you met my conditions freely and for your own sake. If you decided to let me try to help you, then you let me try to help you freely and for your own sake. If you decided to listen to my questions, then you listened freely and for your own sake. If you decided to answer or not to answer, then you answered or not answered freely for your own sake. If you decided to disclose your beliefs to me, then you're the one who decided to disclose your beliefs freely and for your own sake. If you decided to discard a belief, then you decided that freely and for your own sake. If you decided to choose to be happier, then you chose to be happier freely and for your own sake, and I am not the cause. You did this all for yourself. It was all your choice, for your sake, not for mine. I didn't make you choose anything. So this started with, you decided that you had to be unhappy for your sake. And if at the end of this whole list comes to, then you decided to choose to be happier, then you chose to be happier freely and for your own sake. And there was a total freedom on your part throughout the whole thing. I take no credit any more than I would take the blame. The guide does his best guiding. By the way, you may be noticing that I'm using the word guide. I think it's a kind of a nice word. I know it's got acid, you know, trip connotations, but that's their problem. The guide does his best guiding when he knows he is totally non-responsible. It is only possible to really be involved with helping another, not to need help to be happier, by not laying trips, or by not accepting trips being laid on you by the other. Then, only then, is it possible to really be involved. If you have no axe to grind, no need for that other to believe this or that, no need to change them, no need for them to be happier, then you will help best. If you need them for anything during the session, if you need them for anything, then you are subject to blackmail by them. You are subject to agreeing with them that they are not responsible for their feelings. You know, it may even seem cold and unloving if you look at what I've been saying with fear. But it is most loving and freeing for you to be totally unintimidated. The greatest love I might have for you is to tell you that I am not afraid of you, and you are nobody to be afraid of, and you are no one to be afraid of. You owe nothing to your clients. They owe you nothing. You are there for your own sake. When you are in sessions with your clients, you are there for your own sake. You do not have to be there. They are there for their own sakes. They do not have to be there. I want to stress the truly free relationship that's involved. Each one decided for themselves that they wanted to be there. Nobody had to be there. You are not helping them, and you're not deluding yourself that you're helping them because they need your help. They don't need your help. You do it for yourself. They seek help for themselves. Now, they may say they need your help, but you know that they don't. You owe no explanation for what you do in the session or for what you don't do. They may come or not come to you as they wish. They don't want to be with you when you do your thing. They don't have to be with you when you do your thing. In my practice, I find that some clients demand certain things as their rights. And this may be something that you'll face. They have no rights over me any more than I have any rights over them. I do what I wish. They do as they wish. Some think that they are buying or hiring me according to some traditional or mythical rules.
What are they paying for?
They are not. They pay me to do my thing. They're not buying or hiring me. They may pay, if paying is part of it, they pay for me to do my thing. They are free not to do that. They are free not to pay me to do my thing. But if they pay me, they are paying me to do my thing. They are not paying for 50 minutes. They are not paying for me to wear a tie, or not to smoke, or to smile, or not to smile. or to feign sympathy, or whatever. They're not paying for anything other than for me to do my thing. I do what I want. I conduct my business, my sessions, however I want. They are totally free to do their own thing. I will appear eccentric to some, selfish to others, fucked up to some others. But I'll do my thing and they'll do their thing. And unless I know that, how could I ever help them to know that that's what they're doing? Unless I'm in touch, that I am freely choosing to be who I want to be, how could I ever help them to know and understand that they're freely choosing to be what they want to be? I can charge $1 or $100, and I can use whatever criteria I wish. Anything. I could charge $5 for every letter in their name, or double on rainy days. I can show up for sessions or not. I can make my sessions for 5 minutes or 5 hours. I could not be a therapist. I could move to the mountains and contemplate a flower for the rest of my life. I can tell clients, go away, or I can ask them to stay. They are always free to decide. I know that. They are always free to decide what they are willing to do for my help. Just as I will decide what I am willing to do in order to help. The more you're in touch with this true freedom, the more you're in touch with this true freedom to be, the more you'll be able to help others. What we do, what the method is, and why we do it, and what's behind it. That people choose to be unhappy because they believe they have to be. I ask them why they believe they have to be. That's my thing, to ask them why they believe they have to be. Now, if they decide freely, if I ask them these questions, and they decide freely to answer them, and then they decide they don't have to be unhappy. That is their choice. But I became the stimulus, if you want, the questioner, if you want, whatever, that they sought out to ask them that. They wanted somebody to do that for them. If I want to really help you, I'll do my thing by loving, by whatever, right? And I will do the best that I can. But it's important that I know that I'm trying to do my best, that I'm doing my thing. And that they can't sort of decide what is really the best. I mean, people think that I could help them best if I gave them 50 minutes, for instance. That's kind of arbitrary. Maybe I would be more in touch, maybe I would do a better job if I stopped the session at 30 minutes. It's really quite possible, and it's maybe really a bad decision on their part to decide that I should go for the full 50 minutes, the last 20 of which I may not be with them at all. Just as a hypothesis. It doesn't happen to me. I'm usually able to be with them for whatever full time that I give them. But it's certainly not for their benefit to know or to say what it is that I should do. Because what they really want me to do is what I can decide that I can do best. What they want me to do is to help them. They have to decide if that's what I'm wanting too.
Do you see yourself as having the responsibility to tell the patient when you are unhappy with...
No, I see myself having no responsibility.
You could tell them to go away if you wanted.
Yeah, you do what you want. Oh yeah, that's not to say that anything that I might do or everything I would do is going to, ipso facto, be helpful. No, not at all. That's the point. But I am totally free not to be helpful. So that, for instance, if they have... And this is something for you to know. Many of you, as your young, new option therapists, may find that you'll set yourself 50 minutes to help somebody. But in that 50 minutes, you may only find that you're really doing option therapy for 5 minutes. Maybe only 10 minutes are you really doing it. The other time, you might be worried about whether you're doing it or not, so you're not doing it. Okay, fine. But see, they have the right to decide to pay you. They have that right to decide to pay you even for those 10 minutes. Because that's what you're going to do best. If they feel they can get better elsewhere, they're free to do that. But meanwhile, you're doing your best, and if your best is 10 minutes, they may still decide that that's much better than none of it from anybody. that they can't get it anywhere else, and that maybe even for your fumbling is well worth it for whatever they do get from it. So they're free to decide that. You may be a kind of a therapist who, as some are, I always thought it was funny, for instance, Reich used to get up in the middle of a session and say, "I'll be right back," and not come back. And they would go to his house, you know, to see him for 4 sessions, and people would have to travel hundreds and hundreds of miles just to get a session with the master. And he'd be in the midst of a session, and he'd say, "Gee, I want to look up that word." And he'd go off, ostensibly, to go to the dictionary. And in like 15, 20 minutes, he wouldn't be back, and the patient would get up and go out and find him out in the garden, gardening, or something or another. If they didn't like that, if they weren't glad for whatever minutes they had with him, they never had to come back. But apparently what he gave was worth coming for, even if it was, maybe he won't even give it to me today. Maybe he'll be so crazy that he won't even remember that I'm here. And he was prone to do that. And he might go off to chase a flying saucer or something and leave you sitting. And that was the story of Jung, too, in his later days. But see, I don't know that you're going to make the decision that that's good business. That's not what we're talking about. But then if you do decide not to do that, you're doing that freely for your own sake. And if you decide that the average person is not going to put up with that or tolerate it or want it or able to see how good you are in spite of your eccentricities, all right, then you may decide that freely on your own that you will keep certain hours, certain times, charge certain prices, etc., and be consistent, and all the things that you think you need to get what you want. Although you are totally free to charge somebody when they come in, "Hey, this week, by the way, if you want to see me, it'll cost you $500. If you wait till tomorrow, you only have to pay me $10. You're perfectly free to say that. That doesn't mean you will. You may also decide that that's not in your best interest and do otherwise. But to know that you're free is what I'm talking about.
Do we buy the right to see you alone for 15 minutes?
No, buy nothing. I think that the worst that happens is you leave people where they want to be.
I think it's destructive to pretend that things are different than they are.
Well, it's certainly not loving. I don't know how it's destructive. Then you've got another should, thou shalt not pretend.
Well, I don't feel I want to pretend.
That's something else, right? It's not loving to pretend. I mean,
no, it isn't. It isn't.
You pretend. You don't have to sanctify it by saying, "I'm really doing something." You're not doing it. You're pretending. And I guess you may decide that you want to pretend, okay. But that doesn't mean you also have to delude yourself. And you could sit with a patient and wish that they weren't there. Sit with them and wish that they weren't there, but know that that's perfectly all right for you to do that. Because, see, if you don't, you're going to face all kinds of hang-ups. "Oh, my God, I'm not helping them. Oh, my God, this, that," and fuck up even more. To really be free to use all the time, you have to have this attitude. I can only tell you from my own experience, if ever I don't do it, I don't do it. If I don't have that attitude, I'm not going to be able to do my best. That I only do my best knowing that I'm free. I had a patient this week who, in the middle of a session, I decided that if I wanted to listen and really to help them, I was going to get up and go to the toilet to urinate, to relieve my bladder, so that that wouldn't distract me, so that I could do a better job for them. And they deducted that the minute that it took for me to do that, well, they were conscious of it, it cost them $1 while I went to piss. But you see, that comes from the minute by minute, dollar for dollar kind of evaluation. Not that I was there to do my very best for them, and that I could have stayed there and not urinated and just ignored them for a minute, but that would have been okay. Or laid a trip on them, that might have been okay. But to take a minute from their time in order to give them better minutes later didn't quite make sense to me. But again, that would come, if I would fall for that, I couldn't really help them. I wouldn't be helping them.
Is there a general feeling that most people respond better under that model?
I think not. No, I think it's fairly arbitrary. I think that some people, they could really profit a lot more from longer time. Mm-hmm. And other people could do well with more shorter periods, mm-hmm. every day for half an hour. Mm-hmm. Most of these are concessions to finances on most mm-hmm. people's part.
Or a steady calendar.
Yeah, or business or something. Right. In a way, when you're going to schedule you 10 people want to see you in a given day. How do you tell them when to come? So that they would really rather not all be backed up in the waiting room. Especially when, you know, if you're in general practice or something and you don't know how long you're going to see people, your receptionist will just make appointments and pile them up and there'll be 15 people waiting in the waiting room because for all she knows you're going to be 2 minutes with one and a half hour with the other. But in this kind of a practice where you're predictable and you know you're not going to just be probably 2, 3, 4 minutes with anybody, you do it just for their convenience. And so basically the 50 minutes are more cutoff times as maximums rather than minimums or exact amounts. It's just that you won't see anybody longer than 50 minutes. I didn't used to do this, but I tell new patients now that they ask me how long the sessions will be, and I say, I don't know, anywhere from about a minute, but to no more than 50. And if they're willing to come under those conditions, they do. Wouldn't I just have the 50 as a maximum? Will you discuss this during this coffee time now? Will you at least take some time about it to reflect with each other somehow about it? Not the whole period, no, not that whole time, but some of it. Just to share your thoughts with each other about it. Okay, with somebody.